I mean, I think that's another example of probably things being just picked out of context and said, oh, it says, quote, you know, it should be suitable for the active participation of the faithful. Well, that means we need to have a church in the round.
Yes.
Because there's some, you know, social science theory of participation, crowd participation, that we need to look at one another. And you're not reading these things within the context of the whole document itself, plus the other documents speaking to one another. All right, welcome back to another installment of the Deacon of the Dock podcast. It is a bright, sunny day here in College Station, although it started out kind of cloudy.
Yes, I actually got a little drizzle, which I was hoping at least to get some rainfall on the yard, but no such luck. But at least we did not get any of the severe weather that passed just north of us last night. So
yes, we survived inside of the Brazos bubble, as they say, the Aggieland bubble.
The Aggie Dome.
The Aggie Dome, right. Well, we're here talking about the second part of Sacrosanctum Concilium. That's the third of the four documents that we've been considering in our study. Deacon Mike, boy, a lot of new here, a lot of eye-opening passages here for both of us in different regards.
Yes. I was really struck by the language on beauty in Sacrosanctum Concilium. Having grown up in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, when you walked into, especially in Germany.
You mean in the last millennium?
Yes, in the last millennium. Thank you for pointing out how old I am.
Me too. I was there too.
But especially in Germany, we saw so many churches that were basically gutted of anything that spoke of beauty. And so my assumption had been prior to reading Sacrosanctum Concilium that the whole point of the document was to mute down some of the ornateness found in churches. And it says exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
It speaks so much about the need for beauty in every form, in the artwork, in the music, in the decorations in the church, in the placement of objects, that it had to have a form. It had to have something that spoke of the grandeur of God. And while it did point out that everything has to be in a right order, that, you know, you can't just be putting stuff up there because it's beautiful and it might overwhelm the focus on the Eucharist, the focus on the altar. And so it does specify that there must be a right order to all of this. But always an emphasis on beauty. Talking about training composers in liturgy.
Yeah.
And talking about training the clergy in art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says 127, bishops should have a special concern for artists. One of my participants brought up that fact and asked, you know, how well are we doing with that? I mean, is the church doing enough to support artists? You know, she was almost tending towards should we be moving money towards them to kind of prompt them to create works of art for the church? I mean, what an idea. We've been there. We've done that before.
Yes. And when
it gave us the Sistine Chapel.
Exactly. When you think about all the glorious art, especially in the Renaissance, where did it come from?
Mm-hmm.
It came from patronage of the Catholic Church.
That's right. That's right.
And so Sacrosanctum Concilium, in a way, is, again, going backwards.
Schools or academies of sacred art should be founded.
Yes. In the diocese.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of, you know, ever having heard of one.
No, exactly.
And so, again, I think it was surprising to me and most of the people reading this, that emphasis on art and beauty and music and while it did specify certain things that might take pride of place in the liturgy, such as Gregorian chant for music, pipe organs for instruments, all of these things, at no time does it say to the elimination of all else, but simply that there are certain things that lend themselves more neatly to the liturgy.
Yeah, now I was really struck with paragraph 124 in Sacrosanctum Concilium, because it starts off with this, which kind of fits with your 60s, 70s, and 80s presumptions. So it says, ordinaries, by the encouragement and favor they show to art, which is truly sacred, should strive after noble beauty rather than mere sumptuous display. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe that was the culprit. Maybe people with, I hesitate to say bad intentions, but revolutionary tendencies maybe, or modernizing kind of tendencies, maybe they use that as the jumping off point for saying, we need to take down these reredos. We need to, you know, not have high altars anymore, fewer statues. Although 125 says let's be judicious in how many statues we do have in the church. But then that very next paragraph, it says, let bishops carefully remove from the house of God and from other sacred places those works of artists which are repugnant to faith, morals, and Christian piety, and which offend true religious sense, either by depraved forms or by lack of artistic worth, mediocrity, and pretense. That's very strong, firm language from Sacrosanctum Concilium. Yes. I'm wondering, my goodness, what art was repugnant to faith prior to the Second Vatican Council? You know, what was extant already that they were concerned about? Mm-hmm. And then three, that paragraph strikes me as knocking down or calling verboten much of the artistic and architectural reform that followed the council.
Yes.
As I said to you before we started taping, I think every felt banner ever created is under the rubric of mediocrity, in my opinion.
Yes, but I think in taking this in sight of what the rest of the document says, it is so interested in nurturing beauty. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that the church has always done is define beauty as anything that lifts our spirits up to God, anything that we see that is reminded of the ultimate beauty. And I think one of the problems with modern art, and I think this is probably 60s, 70s, and 80s, is that art has become self-expression.
Yeah, self-referential.
Yes. And so what Sacrosanctum Concilium is attempting to remind us of is that true beauty points to God.
Right.
If we're just pointing to ourselves, if our own expression is the definition of art, we've missed the mark.
Mm-hmm.
Because art isn't just something that I have come up with. Art is something that I have been given a talent by God to glorify him with.
Number 122, the arts, quote, achieve their purpose of redounding to God's praise and glory in proportion as they are directed to the more exclusively to the single aim of turning men's minds devoutly toward God.
Exactly what we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, be it music, be it statues, be it paintings, be it icons, and icons are not drawn, icons are written.
That's right.
But
church architecture.
Yes, the beauty of a building. And so, again, all this is with the right motivation, seeking to bring glory to God.
But you go to 125 there, and it says, no, I'm sorry, still in 124, the third paragraph. And when churches are to be built, let great care be taken that they be suitable for the celebration of liturgical services and for the active participation of the faithful. I mean, I think that's another example of probably things being just picked out of context and said, oh, it says, quote, you know, it should be suitable for the active participation of the faithful. Well, that means we need to have a church in the round.
Yes.
Because there's some, you know, social science theory of participation, crowd participation, that we need to look, be able to look look at one another, you know? And you're not reading these things within the context of the whole document itself, plus the documents, the other documents speaking to one another.
Yes, and especially the resulting documents that came out of Sacrosanctum Concilium, like the new missal, which specifies a lot of these things, placement of the altar, placement of like this.
Yeah.
And so we have a tendency as human beings to focus on the things we like and ignore the things we do not like. And I think a large part of the response to Vatican II, and especially Sacrosanctum Concilium, was the nitpicking of the things that speak to our progressive intent rather than what the document was really trying to say.
Yeah, let's move on to something a little bit more pleasing. I wanted to get your thoughts, I said this last time, on the Divine Office. You're a deacon of the Catholic Church. You have to, by law, pray the Divine Office every day. I don't know if you have to pray all of it, but reading the chapter on the Divine Office, it's very much a part of your life. What was that like for you?
Well, one of the things that the Divine Office, and as a deacon, I am only required to do morning and evening prayer, whereas a priest is required to do the office of readings, morning prayer, noon prayer, evening prayer, night prayer. And as many of the other prayers as possible. But the wonderful thing about the Divine Office, the breviary, is that it is set in the liturgical year just as the Mass is.
Right.
It follows the liturgical year. It is intended to be one with the celebration of the Mass, that reading the Divine Office prepares you for the celebration of the Mass, prepares you for living out the liturgical year. And so for me, when I began praying the Divine Office, it was so eye-opening how much more it immerses you in what is happening in that liturgical cycle. The emphasis on the saints, the emphasis on the readings, all of it interconnected. And I find it fascinating because someone had to sit down and look at, because we have a 3-year cycle.
Right.
Well, the Divine Office follows a 4-week rotation. And yet those 4 weeks, the antiphons match the Mass of the day. So for daily Mass, morning prayer and evening prayer contains an antiphon that is written to blend into the readings at the Mass, especially the Gospel readings. So all of this is a cohesive part of our prayer life, to which the high point, of course, is the Mass. But the Divine Office is as much intended to be liturgy as the Mass is. It is intended to be celebrated in community, which sadly rarely happens anymore, but it should be.
Yeah, that's one of the fascinating things about the aftermath of the council, is that something that, from my understanding, was pretty common in parishes was evening vespers being celebrated in community, that died out.
Yes.
And that's not at all what the document seems to intend.
Well, and again, that full active participation was intended to include lauds and vespers.
Yeah.
That the community would gather as community to pray.
I loved in paragraph 84 this quote that, by tradition, going back to early Christian times, the Divine Office is devised so that the whole course of the day and night is made holy by the praises of God. Oh, that's beautiful.
Praying unceasingly.
Yeah.
And this, again, is the whole point of the liturgical year.
Yeah.
It is laid out so at no moment of the day or night, someone is not praying for the church.
Right, right.
I always for RCIA, for Holy Saturday, we usually stop and pray morning prayer for Holy Saturday, which is absolutely beautiful. Mm. But I always remind people that the most sobering thought of doing morning prayer or evening prayer is that it is possible that for even a fraction of a second that I am the only person in the church praying for that fraction of a second. And at that moment, I'm the entire church. Mm. I am praying for everyone else alive. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're called to do. Mm-hmm. We are the church.
Yeah. Yeah, we are. And we're united mystically in his body.
And in prayer.
Yeah. We're getting close to the end of our time. It's gone really fast today. I told you before we started that something that really was eye-opening for me reading Sacro Sanctum Concilium is I came to it thinking this is the document on the Mass. I knew the title was the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, but I thought this is the document on the Mass. I knew that the Divine Office was a part of the liturgy. I didn't realize that officially all the other sacraments are part of the liturgy. Sacramentals like the rosary are part of the liturgy. The liturgical calendar is part of the liturgy. The sacred music, sacred art, all of that together is the liturgy, is the sacred liturgy. That was fascinating to me. I still haven't really pondered what that means, the reality of what that means.
Well, I think it's easiest to understand if we look at what liturgy is.
Work for the people or work of the people.
And a public
yes,
work.
Yes, public work of the people. Or public
and so
work
anything that expresses our faith publicly
right.
is liturgy.
Right.
And so this is why sacramentals, praying your rosary in public.
Right.
Joining together for the divine office, going to Mass, going to a penitential service, going to a baptism. All these things are liturgy. They're intended to be out in public where we profess our faith as community.
Yeah.
And so Sacro Sanctum Concilium, again, is trying to recapture that sense of community of the early church.
Right.
That we are all praying as one and not ashamed of it.
And publicly and communally.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting to kind of go to a church-state relations place. That makes it impossible for Catholics to privatize religion.
Exactly.
Because our whole life as a church is public. We do things publicly. Mm-hmm. We do things communally.
Well, it's like thinking of, you know, somebody asks you your name. Well, it's your name. It's not going to change because you're out in public or you're in private.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is part of your identity.
Right.
The same thing with our faith.
Right.
When I step out the door, I don't leave Catholic behind.
That's right.
It's who I am. And who I am prays. Who I am speaks in religious language. Who I am does things that are hopefully always morally correct.
Right.
Not because the government tells me to, but because who I am.
Right. And that's what a great place to sort of set the stage for our last document, and that's Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world. I mean, that document is going to be all about how do we go out and live and sanctify the world because we are Catholic, because we are a church, because we are the mystical body of Christ. What does that look like?
Well, in a way, this sort of explains why the language changes between the other constitutions and Gaudium et Spes. Mm-hmm. Gaudium et Spes is what's referred to as a pastoral constitution. It's shepherding. It is not directing as dogma. Mm-hmm. And so it is intended to guide not just us as Catholics, but it's sort of a forewarning to everybody else that this is what Catholic is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. When you bump into these people, this is what they're going to be. Mm-hmm. This is what they're going to look like. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that.
And just to kind of tease what we're going to have to enjoy in this document is a really famous passage from Gaudium et Spes, and that's this. It's Gaudium et Spes 22. For Adam, the first man, was a figure of him who was to come, namely Christ the Lord. Christ, the final Adam, by the revelation of the mystery of the Father and his love, fully reveals man to man himself and makes his supreme calling clear.
And this, I think, is the beautiful aspect of Gaudium et Spes. What it tells us throughout the document is the world is broken. Mm-hmm. And man by himself cannot fix it.
No.
Because man didn't create it. And the only answer to all the problems in the world is Jesus.
Yes. So we'll be back together after Easter. Start doing your reading on Gaudium et Spes now, because we've got some heavy weeks ahead of reading. But it's going to be great. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time on The Deacon of the Dock. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Deacon of the Dock podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please consider going to redsearadio.org/donate and supporting religious education for the domestic church.